You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The divide in our nation continues a day after President Trump's acquittal on charges of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts presiding over the Senate trial.
Two-thirds of the senators present not having pronounced him guilty, the Senate adjudges that respondent Donald John Trump, President of the United States, is not guilty as charged in the second article of impeachment.
Will this moment have a long-lasting repercussions on our democracy? How will the divisions we see in the halls of power in Washington filter down to our communities? Is our system working the way our founders intended it to? We're at 800-642-1234. Jasmine Ferrier is chair and professor of the Political Science Department at the University of Louisville. Jasmine, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So from your constitutional perspective, what was the significance of this acquittal on our country, on our democracy?
The constitutional significance is yet to be determined because impeachment is considered to be an extreme form of checks and balances. So it's unclear whether this will set a new standard that we will have partisan impeachments on a more regular basis, than perhaps the founders intended. We'll wait and see. Again, so if a Democratic president is elected with a Republican House, is this going to be the institutional routine?
You study the separations of power in our government. Does the president or Congress emerge stronger from this impeachment battle?
That's very hard to tell. And as a political scientist who has been chastened by poor predictions in the past, I will demur on what this means for the election this year. But again, the Constitution envisions a vibrant separation of power system that, frankly, is not supposed to go to the extreme of impeachment. Congress, by any stretch, has the vast majority of institutional powers that it needs to get its way if it's united and believes in its own institutional place. So again, Congress can reinvigorate the existing, quote, regular political, institutional, and constitutional powers against any president if it's united in trying to become more of a leader in the country's direction.
Throughout the impeachment process, President Trump did not comply with subpoenas from Congress for additional witnesses, additional documents. Is it unusual for a president to defy Congress in this way?
It is unusual, and Congress, including the leadership in the House, could have gone through the court system to demand compliance. That would bring a more fraught area into the question, because if the president defied a court order, then it would become a more three-branch separation of powers dilemma. In general, again, Congress has lots of ways to get the president to comply if it's united and tries other methods. So, for example, Congress can negotiate with the president regarding, in the Senate, any confirmation battles that are on the agenda. In the House, it can be regarding appropriations and budget processes. The president needs congressional authority, frankly, and money to do what he wants to do, as he laid out in his State of the Union address. So the system is not meant to be controlled unilaterally by one side, one party, or one branch, or even one person. So Congress needs to, again, think more united in their view of their place against the president. Of course, that's very hard to do when you have different parties in control of the House and Senate.
We're talking with political scientist Jasmine Ferrier. She wrote the book Constitutional Dysfunction on Trial, and we're exploring the ripple effects, what could emerge from the impeachment trial. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jasmine, one of the president's lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, argued that when the president does something that, quote, he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that he cannot be impeached for that. What do you make of that view of executive power?
That's an extreme version of what President Nixon said. After he was out of office, if the president does it, it's not illegal. This is an argument that, frankly, a lot of modern presidents make, maybe not in the crystal clear way that Alan Dershowitz put it. But both Democratic and Republican presidents in the modern era conflate their personal interest, their policy interests, and the national interest routinely. When presidents talk about the national interest, they're talking about their interest. And their interest can include personal ambition as well as policy goals. this rhetoric, again, is perhaps a few shades beyond what is normal, but it's a version of the world that presidents say and see routinely. If you think about war powers, for example, even though this president is saying, I can do things that will help my reelection, we do wonder where previous presidents have used their power in the Oval Office to further their reelection in reality. Maybe they don't say it that way, but if they use war powers, budget powers, trade and tariff powers, immigration powers, these are all related to their electoral goals as well.
So it becomes increasingly difficult to tease out what's personal and what's policy.
It certainly is. And the Federalist Papers actually anticipated a version of this. Of course, again, not like the Dershowitz version. But Federalist Paper 51 says, and I'll paraphrase, that personal ambition should be wrapped up with institutional ambition using constitutional means. In other words, the Federalist Papers envisioned a society where, yes, you have ambitious politicians contending for power. They use their power through the checks and balances system. The wrinkle that we are missing today is that the branches are not all using them. The president is overwhelming Congress routinely by using powers without responses. So again, what the framers assumed in a checks and balances system is that all the branches would have a personal and electoral incentive to engage each other, not roll over for the president because he happens to be of the same party.
Jasmine, do you anticipate that impeachment will be used as a political weapon by the parties in the future?
That's exactly what I fear. It would be the equivalent of institutional gangland warfare, because we do not want the levers of constitutional power to be used as revenge tactics against the next administration. We've already seen miniature versions of that in the Senate. So just to quickly digress, Harry Reid, when he was the majority leader of the Senate, started blocking George W. Bush's judicial nominees. Then leader Mitch McConnell decided to use the same tactics against judicial nominees. And then leader McConnell ratcheted it up by failing to place any time in the Senate's calendar, either in the committee system or on the floor, for Merrick Garland's judicial nomination in 2016. So in return, when the Democrats return to power in the Senate, will they respond in kind? They will feel like suckers, pardon my language, unless they say, well, they're going to do the same things to the Republicans did to them. Let's move it over to the House. Will the next Democratic president facing an opposition House of Representatives be subject to impeachment? I'm not denying that there were causes for this investigation, but there's no question that the party is going to take this very, very personally, the Republican Party, and perhaps seek revenge when it's their institution's time to be in power.
Very quickly, before we have to let you go, how significant was it that Senator Mitt Romney defied his party by voting that President Trump was guilty on one charge?
It is very significant, but remember, Senator Romney answers to the majority of people in Utah. And I was looking this morning, there is a Tribune editorial for the Salt Lake Tribune, and it says Mitt Romney's profile and courage. I'm not sure what the other newspapers are saying, but again, he answers to his constituents, and that's the way that separation of powers thrives, because there is no one central authority. Everybody in Congress, in the House and Senate, is a winner. They won in their district in the House, and they won in their state in the Senate. They answer to their voters, and his next election is 2024. So Mitt Romney might get the cold shoulder from his Republican Party, but ultimately he will answer to the people of Utah.
Jasmine, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure. Anytime.
Jasmine Farrier is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Louisville.